8:15. Apparently, I'm getting some texts here from people with the satellite radio. They changed the picture that's up there from the one that was of me with a bow tie when I was like, 3,000 pounds. And Darren says, now you can actually see my eyes because my fat little cheeks haven't closed all of that up between my cheeks and my forehead. Arthur Hardy joins us now. Either way, I hope it doesn't frighten you.
I'm so glad they did that. I've thought the same thing. That's the very, very old Tommy, or former or fatter, let's call it what it was.
I hope it doesn't startle anybody as they drive. I certainly hope not. Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guy, joins us now. How you doing, Arthur?
I'm good. Just got back from 2.5 weeks in Norway visiting our grand twins and had a wonderful time. 58 degrees, 20% humidity, and then I step off the plane at Moisant.
And get driven into the ground, right? Felt like Demario Davis just sacked you, is what you felt like.
Oh, man. Anyway, it's good to be home, except for the weather.
You know what? I was talking to J.P. Moreau yesterday about what's going on with ocean and so forth, and I got to thinking after the conversation was over and throughout the day yesterday, it seems like, and you're a local guy, you can tell me what you think. In the 80s, I don't know if it was the oil bust or what, but it seems like Mardi Gras went crazy with everybody. It expanded too much. Country clubs went crazy because the oil boom was here, and it expanded too much, and there was not enough money to support either. And now it seems like things are starting to contract back to where what is the right size. And I know you can't speak to country clubs, but am I onto something here with Mardi Gras or not? Because ultimately, it's the greatest free show on earth, but it costs a ton of money.
Well, it does, and yet you have crews lining up to take the place if there is one, if a crew goes out of business, and don't write Ocean off just yet. Not that you have, but some people have. Yeah. I have an idea they're going to be back in some fashion. But the point is what JP and this Governmental Affairs Committee did yesterday, and I applaud them for it, to try to have some sort of process in place. If we're going to have a new parade, what kind of criteria will it be held to so it's not a one-off? You know, we're preparing for our 50th anniversary Mardi Gras Guide, and I've been doing a lot of looking back, and this number astonished me. Since 1977, when we started the magazine, if you look at last year's parade schedule, 29 of the parades from last year have been founded in those last 49 years. But in that same period, catch this, 75 parades have gone out of business. Mm-hmm. 75. And that's in Orleans, Jefferson, St. Bernard, St. Tammany. So, you know, parades come and go. But I think JP's quite correct. If and when there's a spot available, let's be darn sure that whoever we give it to is financially viable and is not a one-off.
Well, and he talked about kicking the tires on it. I understand that. We do diligence, call it whatever you want. But how do you go about? First of all, Arthur, let me take a step back. If I'm going to start a Mardi Gras crew, if I decide I want to have the crew of Tucker, well, Tux is already used. Let's make it something else. Screw Tommy. How do I even go about this? Because the first thing I got to do is I got to have capital. I got to get people to sign up. I don't know what kind of contracts they sign to join the crews. Take me through all of that, because I think we take that for granted when we set up the lawn chairs and we don't realize the business part behind it.
Well, exactly. I mean, well, the first thing you have to do is find out, is there a spot for you to parade? I mean, in Orleans, there isn't. So forget that at this point. There's certainly a positions in St. Tammany and Jefferson and St. Bernard. But my first step would be to go to governmental officials and say, hey, if I can put this together, will you allow us to parade? If not, you're wasting your time. But it always starts with capital, and that starts with members. And the question always is, why should I join the crew of Tommy when they're 30 clubs that are looking for members and advertising them on the internet? Why not join a crew that has a 10-year track record? So it's a really tough sell to start a new crew. Then you've got to hire, a contract with float builders. You have to have, in every parish, there's a minimum number of bands you have to have. Competition for them is very great. And where and when are you going to parade? I mean, how many, again, there's all kind of positions available outside of New Orleans. But let's face it, everybody wants to be on St. Charles Avenue. So it's a tough sell. I could never recommend anybody try to start a club right now. Now, there are some existing organizations that have a ball but not a parade, or their members ride in a crew already, and their thinking is, well, you know, if we pull all these guys out of Crew X, we can start our crew of Tommy. But it's a business. It's a business, and it takes a lot of capital and leadership. You better you better have been an officer in an existing parade and know the ropes before you try to be a captain of a new club.
Are these set up as LLCs, Arthur? Is there a board that runs these things? How does that action?
Well, by law, they have to be nonprofit organizations. And some are captains, some are boards. You know, that it can be done in different ways. You have to register with the state. But frankly, I think we have enough parades. Maybe we have too many. Mm-hmm. Parades ending at 1 in the morning is just not acceptable. It's an embarrassment of riches. It really is.
That's what I'm saying. It seems like less could be more. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, all right? Because I think less could be more. I really do, and that's what I mean by overexpansion. And all right, 820, Arthur Hardy, our guest here. Any thoughts on Mardi Gras? You can text them in to 504-260-1870. No texting and driving. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Traffic now, WWL. 4.5, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Arthur Hardy, publisher of the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide, who's working on the 50th issue, I guess, as we speak, Arthur? Yes?
You better believe it.
All right, so, you know, we're talking about less being more and parades going until 1 o'clock. How do you fix that? And let me take a step back first, because, you know, I've ridden in a couple of, I was a Grand Marshal of Tux one year, and I was lucky enough to do that, and Ed Muniz hooked me up a couple of times to ride in a parade. But one thing to me, it's all about, and it's, I make another analogy to golf, or another, bring up golf again, it's about who you play with. So when when crews say, you know, you can ride, have the experience of this or that, the other thing, is that as good? Do people value that as much as if they don't know who they're standing next to or riding with or partying with?
No, I don't think so. And that's why people want to start a new club, just you know, us and the guys, and we'll bring some other friends and join up. And that's all, just about all these crews started with a bunch of like-minded people who had something in common, worked together, fraternities played together, you know, same neighborhood. But it's different now. And, of course, with so many opportunities to ride, you have choices. So maybe you don't go solo. Maybe, you know, the co-ed clubs, obviously, you bring your significant other. Or, you don't have to go by yourself. But it's just, I just think it's gotten so big, and we need to maybe pull it back a little bit. And, of course, the way to do that is to try not to have triple-header parades. Mm-hmm. And that was a really good idea this year when Allah moved from that first Friday night where we had a triple-header, first Friday night, yeah, that's right, to the spot vacated by Knicks. So that made a double-header that night, which is manageable, and that first Friday, instead of having three parades, you had two. So that made sense. But now we're talking about if we lose a parade. I really think the schedule in New Orleans is not going to change for the next couple of years. I think what we have is relatively solid. Now, Oshun has had its problems for several years with finances, with the quality and quantity of the units in the parade, and it's tough. It's expensive business, but I just have a feeling something's going to be worked out to it. They don't lose that permit, because that permit is really precious.
It would seem like consolidation, and I know this is not going to happen because it's social groups, right? But if you could consolidate a couple of these into, what are your thoughts on this? And no disrespect to anybody, but it seems like the more parades you have, the more groups you need, the more bands you need. There are only so many groups, so many bands that go around, which means you wind up with some units that maybe technically fit the bill, but not really add a lot to the parade, if you understand what I'm saying. Again, no disrespect to anybody. But it would seem like you'd do better to consolidate some of these and maybe have a couple of more super crews or something along those lines where you could have synergy and have bigger and better while doing with less, if that makes sense.
It does, but mergers have been tried and have almost never worked.
How come? Because the social part of it?
Yeah, and egos, who's the captain, who's the boss, who sits on the board. One example where it has worked is the Mystic Order of Phoenix, which rides with Sparta. That has worked, but in truth, would the ladies rather ride as their own crew? I bet they would, but there's no permit available. So, you know, there are ways to do this, but it's not easy. And remember, this is also just supposed to be about having fun.
Right.
It's, you know, the old JP mentioned yesterday about, you know, how watching Mardi Gras get organized is like watching making sausages. so many things you don't realize. But there was another significant thing that happened at a meeting yesterday. It's gotten overlooked. the alternative parades, the Chewbacca's of the world, Coupe de Vue, you know, Joan of Arc, that are technically not Mardi Gras parades because they're out of the 12-day window leading up to Fat Tuesday. They have different ordinances and all. He's trying to kind of tighten up that permitting process with early deadlines that will allow the public and these crews and businesses along the routes to know early on what the parade routes are. These groups have had routes changed 48 hours before the parades the last few years, and that's because the NOPD is not charged with policing those groups. Off-duty police officers can sign up to be a part of the safety patrol for those units. So it depends on how many people line up, how long the route can be. Well, that's fine, but let's know it 2 months out, not 2 days out. So that's going to be tightened up, and that's going to give these crews a lot more stability and flexibility to understand, here's where we're going, guys. I've known businesses that bought, 28 extra cases of Budweiser and then found out the parade's not going there. And that's not fair.
And then they had to invite you over, and you took care of that. Listen, outside,
a long time ago.
me too, Arthur. Outside of the 12 days that you're talking about, has there been an expansion of groups that are parading or not really?
Yeah. I mean, yes, indeed.
Too much or not?
No, I don't think so. This is the artsy part of Mardi Gras, and you don't have to have a lot of money to join, but it's
the true organic part, almost.
It is, and it's diversity at its best, and I think they complement the quote-unquote real parades. They don't compete with them, and they're drawing big audience. I mean, Chewbacca's hit, I think, 2,000 people on foot and about a four-hour parade this year. So God bless them,
Thank you. Thank you, Arthur. Good luck with the humidity. You'll adjust eventually.
I will. Thank you, buddy.
Or die. Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. We'll talk to Joe Ogeron about Menhaden when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. It is currently 8:46, 14 till 9. I love talking to smart people. I really do, because I always learn something. And one of those joins us now who happens to be a representative. That's not what makes him smart. No disrespect. What makes him smart is he's a physicist. How you doing, Joe Ogeron?
I'm doing fine, Tommy. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Do you think if you devoted every second of your life for the next 20 years, you could teach me physics?
Absolutely. I think we could.
That's a fool's errand. Believe me, you'd never make any headway at all. Let's talk about what's going on with the men. And I just like to bring that up because you are a scientist and you know what you're talking about. And I think it's great when people that are educated, and we need lawyers in the legislature. We need, doctors, and we need other things. We also need scientists in the legislature to keep an eye on what's going on and do things for the right reasons. Tell me what's going on with the Menhaden industry and a new study that's out. Well, first of all, Joe, take a step back. Yeah. A lot of people don't know what Menhaden is or what the Menhaden industry is, so maybe you can start there for context.
All right. Well, menhaden is a small one of the most important fish in the Gulf because even though it's nothing that's edible by humans, it's a small, bony and oily fish. It still can be caught in massive numbers and provide lots of protein, and most of your omega-3 oil that goes into your fish oil pills actually comes from menhaden.
How big are these things, Joe?
They're only about 5 or 6 inches long.
You would never eat this on a plate or anything like that, right?
Never.
They always process them. Okay.
Always process. And it's a very important. It's the U.S.'s second largest fishery, and here in the Gulf, it's one of Louisiana's largest fisheries. The amount of weight of menhaden, or also the common name is pogies, the amount of weight that they catch in a year. There's primarily two companies that do this, and the amount of weight basically equals everything else Louisiana catches. Every oyster meat, every shrimp, crawfish, turtle, crab meat, redfish, snapper. You add everything else up that comes out of Louisiana's waters, and you put it side by side with the amount of menhaden that they catch, or pogies, and they're about equal. So that's how much we catch.
And I want to get that out there because I know a guy that's a maritime attorney, and up until 10 years ago, I had no idea what a menhaden was. And since then, I've been blown away with how important they are and what a big part of the catch in the Gulf they are. But They can also be controversial, and also they are different regulations, I think, for the way they fish in the Gulf with different states, right? Take me through that.
Well, Louisiana probably has the most lax regulations. I mean, they're probably thinking that they're overregulated, but the point is that they fish in Louisiana because they can't fish in Florida. They have a quota limit, and it's almost in Texas that's probably not enough for them to spend the money going over there and fishing unless the menhaden move there and they go for a short time just to fill up that small quota that Texas allows, and everywhere else. Even the only other place where it's done is on the East Coast is Chesapeake Bay area in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And there they have large, you know, more stringent restrictions. Louisiana is kind of like, I'm going to call it the last Wild West for industrial reduction menhaden. And let me parse those words. Industrial is that they use basically large OSV, the same kind of boats that we use in the oil and gas industry to move equipment to the oil rigs. Usually those vessels, whenever they're done with their service, they're bought up by these menhaden companies and converted so that all the tanks that used to bring out water or drilling muds and stuff are now storage tanks for the menhaden and pumping systems and netting systems and things like that. So
let me take a quick break right here, Joe, because I think we reached a good stopping point. I got to get traffic in. Okay. Then when we come back, we can talk about, because they do cast a wide net, not metaphorically, but literally. They catch a lot of stuff in it, and we'll talk about redfish and other species and what kind of effect they have on it when we come back. Representative Joe Ogeron, our guest, our friend, he's a physicist. More when we return. Traffic now, WWL. 56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Representative Joe Ogeron, a physicist, a scientist. We've already established what the menhaden or pogie industry is. They do have these big boats that cast wide nets. They catch a lot. They get a lot of stuff in there that they, besides pogie or menhaden. Joe, what does this study show about the bycatch, the things that get caught in there that become entangled, that get killed and wasted, and what happens from here?
Okay, well, one of the biggest surprises was that a lot of the user conflict were from recreational fishermen that fish alongside right off the beach where these industrial menhaden fisheries like to fish where the fish are, of course. Mm-hmm. And they use spotter planes to find them and basically cast the net around there. And the user conflict with the recreational fishermen is whenever they're done, there's usually dead redfish floating out on the water. Mm-hmm. And the biggest surprise was that they were thinking that as they encircle the menhaden and whatever else is making the menhaden school, let's say in this case, redfish, jack crevalles, sharks, whatever else it is, they all get encased in this netting. And they're as they squeeze the net to a small area and suck out the menhaden, what's left in the net is one of the three types of bycatch. That's called the rollover bycatch, whatever's left. And they was believed that was where the redfish were dying, but this report shows that the vast majority of those in the net remain in the net after they suck out the vast majority of the menhaden survive. The other side of that coin is there are some redfish and other species that get sucked up in the hose with the menhaden, generally the smaller sized redfish and other species. And those that pass through the, let's call it the pumping process of getting brought on board, and even though once it's on board, there's like a bars, grade bars that the menhaden and very small bycatch fish fall through, but the larger fish, like the redfish and sharks, they get sucked up in the hose. Those, unfortunately, the other side of the coin is those have a horrible survival rate. Like only 5% of them.
So, Joe,
the vast majority of them die.
Before we run out of time, as a scientist, what do you do with this data? What do you do next?
All right, so the main thing I wanted to know from this data was, how close to the beach.
Hey, Joe?
Been always the user conflict. Is
Joe, there's no way we're going to get this in before the news. That's important, though. I want to ask you to hang on, okay, and I'll wrap this up after the news, and we'll talk about dogs. Can you hang on a minute?
Sure.
All right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was running as late as we were, but I think it is important. So we'll talk about where we go from here with Menhaden. Then we'll talk about what puppies think with a guy that runs a college at Duke University about puppies.